and the Great Orient Express steams away with a trainload of passengers, one of whom is to meet a violent, bloody, and well-planned death. The woman who thought it all up in the first place? Well, you've heard the name of the program, so I don't have to tell you. Dame Agatha Christie, a lady as self-effacing as her novels are famous.
People often ask me what made me take up writing. Many of them, I fancy, wonder whether to take my answer seriously, although it's a strictly truthful one. You see, I put it all down to the fact that I never had any education.
The voice, and incidentally, a very rare recording of Dame Agatha herself. If someone were so foolhardy as to try and discover how many books she's sold, how many people have seen The Mousetrap, how much money she's made, how many people have been to the cinema to see her films, they'd rapidly get lost in the sheer weight of numbers. It's probably best to say, quite simply, that for as long as most people can remember, Dame Agatha, the lady who claims to have had no real education, has been delighting countless millions of readers and filmgoers and theatregoers with what was once called the gentle art of murder. And it is a gentle art. Dame Agatha is not the kind of lady to give you bad dreams because her crimes happen in such pleasant surroundings and among, apparently, the nicest kind of people. Anyway, back to Dame Agatha and her education, or lack of it.
I did eventually go to school in Paris when I was 16, or thereabouts. But until then, apart from being taught a little arithmetic, I'd had no lessons to speak of at all. Although I was gloriously idle, in those days, children had to do a good many things for themselves. They made their own dolls' furniture, and they made Christmas presents to give to their friends. Nowadays, they're just given money and told to buy their presents in a big store.
Finding a name for a program isn't always as easy as it looks, so why call this one The Mysterious Dame Agatha? The answer, quite simply, is that, in her own way, she is a mysterious person. Quiet, self-effacing, and very definitely anti-limelight. Someone who has met her is the actor Nigel Stock, who appeared in one of her plays, not The Mousetrap, incidentally. He remembers both the play and the author.
It was called The Unexpected Guest. It was interesting from the point of view that the whole of the first act, which was divided up into two scenes, the first scene of which, where only two people were involved. And this meant that you had to try and hold the audience in that first scene. And it was terribly important that you did, otherwise the play just went down the drain. That was the tough part of the play. The play actually was set in Wales, and I played a character called Michael Starkweather, who had been with an oil company in some part of Arabia, and who suddenly appeared in a house when there was a thick fog coming up from the Bristol Channel. And then discovered a corpse in the room.
And, as I said, Nigel Stock also remembers meeting the author after a somewhat abortive beginning.
Well, it was a fascinating experience. The first time when I really felt I was going to see her was at the reading of the play, which was at the Savoy Theatre, and Peter Saunders had presented this play, you see, and we all assembled there for the first time, meeting one another, hoping that the lady was going to be present. But she sent a wire or a message which said she was unable to be present because she was making raspberry jam. So that was the first encounter, which didn't happen. But when it did happen, I was immediately spellbound, I think is the only word I can use. It sounds a little bit way out, but it really means that you know how you get an idea of somebody before you meet them. And when you do meet them, it's, in this case, completely and utterly wrong. This lady was shy, very gentle, very unassuming, and thoroughly charming. I was completely bowled over by her.
Peter Saunders, who staged the legendary Mousetrap, also recalls her shyness, which has in no way lessened the pleasures of her home life.
She is one of the most unforgettable characters I have ever met. She's desperately shy, this is no pose, and yet in her own home, she's very voluble. I've stayed with her several times in her beautiful home at Devonshire. And it's one of those country homes where you have large chintz armchairs, everybody's terribly friendly. When you come down to breakfast, there's nothing formal. The gong goes, but you come down just when you like, and you find eggs, bacon, kidneys, tomato, bacon on the sideboard on heated plates. You help yourself. If Agatha happened to be down, you say good morning, but she quickly disappears behind the newspaper, as you yourself do. And after breakfast, she'd say, well, everybody does whatever they want to do in this house. Most of us play cricket. Well, it seemed a rather odd pastime for this fairly middle-aged gathering. But this was because of her son, who was then only 8 years of age. And we used to play cricket in the nets they had there. And year after year, he got older and older and more difficult to get out. And when he captained Eton at Lord's, well, we didn't get him out.
And besides the shyness?
She's somebody who has an enormous variety of interests. She used to go out to Baghdad and take all the colour slides for her husband, Sir Max Mallowan, who is an archaeologist of great distinction. She can talk about politics, she can talk about sport, and she does. There's nothing reticent about her among her own personal friends. It's with strangers that she seems to shy away. She dislikes personal publicity, and the fact that she's had an enormous amount is not of her own wish or doing. I've put on about 10 of her plays in the West End, and it is almost impossible to get her to meet the press. And it's sometimes a little embarrassing because I tell the press that she'd rather not meet them, and then she might suddenly relent and do it on a personal basis, and I get blamed. There was one American journalist who was unable to get an interview with her, but happened to go to some function and met her in the ladies' lavatory. And she introduced herself as a journalist and asked one or two questions there, and got a very good interview out of it.
Her shyness was something which certainly struck Julian Simmons, himself the author of some highly successful detective novels.
Personally, Agatha Christie is quite genuinely and absolutely shy. People often say that they're shy, when in fact it isn't true. But she is an extremely difficult person to get to know. I wouldn't claim that I've got to know her at all well. On the other hand, once doing an interview with her with a tape recorder, which I took along, my inefficiency with the tape recorder was such as to break the barrier of shyness. And she revealed all sorts of things to me that she doesn't generally say, such as that she very much prefers Miss Marple to Poirot. If they write to me, she said, they write and say how much I must love him. If they only knew. And so on. In general, Agatha Christie is so shy that, for example, she's the president of a group of crime writers called the Detection Club, but she only became the president on the basis that she wouldn't on any account make even the shortest speech of the yearly dinners.
How does Julian Simmons regard her as a writer?
I should call her A sort of Cleopatra of the home counties, a serpent of old Thames, in the sense that all her characters seem to come from the home counties. They don't always. Sometimes they're to be found in Mesopotamia, as she calls it in one book. But essentially, that's what they are. They're essentially all middle class. The murderer will certainly be found from among that social group. Now, within that rather limited context, she employs the most dazzling ingenuity. In a way, this is the sort of detective story that I don't like very much. And yet she does it so marvellously, she does it so brilliantly, she pulls the wool over a reader's eyes so skillfully that one's got to admire it, and in my case, one's got to like it.
Does she have any faults, then?
She's got lots of faults, of course, so we all have. I suppose her chief fault, which has been pointed out by a lot of people, is being a tremendously slapdash writer in the literal grammatical sense. I don't much mind about this. I think these faults are obviously not cancelled, but they're certainly balanced by the virtues of writing often really quite brilliant dialogue, I think. Dialogue which hasn't actually been assessed at its proper value. This is being rather pompous. I wouldn't claim, nor no more would she claim, tremendously high literary virtues for her work. But I think they've got, I think it's got more virtues than people have given it credit for.
One question, of course, which has to be asked and probably can't be answered, is the success of her play, The Mousetrap. Why has this play of all plays had such a phenomenal run? Peter Saunders was asked if he had any idea when he staged it that it would go on and on and on.
I thought it would be a success, and then when I managed to get Richard Attenborough and Sheila Sims signed up, I thought it would be a big success, and by big success, I forecast 14 months. I certainly had no idea that it was going to make world theatrical history. There came a point in its history, I suppose after 5 or 6 years, when it became the longest-running play this country's ever known, when it was a question of perpetual motion. I mean, it became one of the sights of London, like Buckingham Palace, the Tower of London. The tourists flocked to see it. Children, when they became of mousetrap age, whatever that is, 9 or 10, came to see it, and their brothers had to come and see it. But what made it reach that point of no return, I don't know. People like it, but they like a lot of plays. Now, of course, it's a freak, and people like seeing freaks. I think this is a rather gentle form of murder. There is nothing grisly or gruesome. There's nothing to make anybody have nightmares. It's a puzzle. It has all the ingredients of the best of all quiz programs. It's a puzzle. It has comedy. It has drama. It's a guessing game, and the whole family can see it. I don't think this is the answer as to why it's run so long. But this is why people like it, and they tell their friends, and the friends see it, and so it goes on.
Whatever the reason, The Mousetrap has become a theatrical phenomenon. After it had chalked up its first decade, the first 10 years of continuous performance, the BBC sent a reporter down to the theatre to talk to the author herself, who wasn't giving away a word more than she meant to.
Do you often go to see your own plays? How often have you seen The Mousetrap?
Oh, about 40 or 50 times, I think.
Do you ever find that you forget the plot? Wonder who did it?
No, I can't say that.
What's your recipe for a successful thriller?
I wouldn't know.
Somebody's quoted you as saying that you get your best plots at the kitchen sink. Does this mean that murder is to you a cosy subject?
No, I don't think so. I think that if you're doing something rather monotonous that doesn't require much thought, you very often get ideas coming into your head, really.
Violent ideas?
No, just ideas about your work. They needn't be violent. Neat tricks, I should describe them as, more than...
Well, most of your violence is, I think, polite and certainly polished. What do you think of the modern sex and sadism school?
Well, I don't like it very much. Too old, I expect. I think it's rather like reading a medical book, you know, rather dull catalogue.
The same interviewer had rather more luck when he talked to one of the original stars of the show, Richard Attenborough.
Richard Attenborough, you were in the first production of The Mousetrap. How long was it before you managed to free yourself?
Well, I was able to free myself after 6 months, but I in fact stayed for nearly 2 years.
Have you ever returned to the scene of the crime since you left it?
Yes, about 6.5 years ago.
What did you think?
I thought it was magnificent theatre. It's most skillfully written, you know. It's incredibly skillfully written.
That's the secret of its success and long run.
Well, I think anybody would be a fool who didn't admit that one of the reasons for its long run is that it's in a comparatively small theatre. I think if it had been playing in Theatre Royal Drury Lane, you know, it wouldn't have run so long, obviously.
Of course, as we've heard, there have been other successful Christie plays, and Nigel Stock had the lead in one of them. But what did he think of the characters? Were they taken from Stock, or did they have a three-dimensional life of their own?
There was no depth. You see, they all appeared to be sort of stock characters. I mean, the Major was very much the Major. The Butler was Jeevesian, but with very much sort of, well, Murder in the Crypt tones, you know what I mean? But very difficult to act, I thought. And the only way you could do that was just simply to forget about any sort of cardboard quality and just go in and try and make it into somebody of flesh and blood.
We're still a long way from finding out just how she does it. Those neat, easy-to-read stories of death on the vicarage lawn or just behind the rhododendron beds or on the golf links. Julian Simmons defines the classic Agatha Christie whodunit.
You have a group of suspects who are all in the same, who are all in the same social category. That is to say, you will very likely have the local doctor, the local solicitor, and the local squire will be three essential figures. What makes it then is that the body is found in the library, and there are lots of clues, and there is a confrontation at the end. And so on. This is the formula, but of course that doesn't mean that she sticks to that formula in the rigid way that I'm suggesting. You can see, though, a perfect instance of it in Murder on the Orient Express, where essentially this pattern is being fulfilled. It's perfectly true. It isn't in a library, it's in a train, it's on the Orient Express. But the suspects are all gathered together. There has to be the private detective, in this case Poirot, sometimes Miss Marple, to solve the crime. And there has to be, my word, isn't there, in Murder on the Orient Express, a really gigantic session at the end with Poirot saying, it might be you, it might be you, it might be you, but... So that's the essential Agatha Christie pattern.
What does the author herself have to say about it? As one might expect from what we've heard of her, she's bland, down-to-earth, matter-of-fact, as she describes her early efforts.
I found myself making up stories and acting the different parts, and there's nothing like boredom to make you write. So by the time I was 16 or 17, I'd written quite a number of short stories and one long, dreary novel. By the time I was 21, I'd finished the first book of mine ever to be published, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. I'd sent it to one or two publishers who didn't want it, and eventually it went to John Lane. About a year later, I heard it had been accepted. Well, that's how it began, and since that time, I've written something like 55 books and half a dozen plays.
But no, it really won't do. There's more to it than that. Not everyone who sat down at the typewriter has managed to turn out even a moderately successful whodunit, let alone book after book, year after year, in the way that The Mousetrap goes on season after season. Mitchell Raper talked about her selling power to the manager of a leading West End bookshop.
She's the only writer whose books we would buy without any question. It isn't when we hear of a new book of Christie's, we simply buy it, and buy it again, and buy it again. There's never a bad Christie book as far as sales are concerned. Other writers, of course, one has to be fairly careful because you can never be sure how they go. But there is a great Christie following, and we know that we get a lot of people who are customers of Mowbray's, and they come back and come back again for Christie novels.
Is there such a thing as a typical Christie buyer, a typical Christie customer?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I seem to sell most Christie novels, in hardback that is, anyway, to middle-aged men. Whether that says very much about her readership or not, I can't say, but that's the sort of typical customer that's in my mind.
Have you yourself ever read an Agatha Christie novel?
Yes, when I was about 19 or 20, which is a fair while ago now, I read my first Agatha Christie and got hooked. In other words, I had read other crime novels for what I thought then was light relief, but always of very different authors. Once I'd read a Christie, I wanted to read more, and in fact for a period of 5, 6, 7 years, if ever I read a crime novel, it was one of Agatha Christie's.
What did you like about her?
The characters she created and the situations that she wrote about were totally believable. In other words, it was very easy to believe the plot, if you like. There was nothing fantastic to me about anything she wrote. It could have happened just around the corner or in one's own home sometimes.
So booksellers like the sound of her name, quite apart from the encouraging rattle of the till. The bookseller said that he sold a lot of her books to middle-aged men. One customer he obviously hadn't come across was 7-year-old Matthew Woolard, who at a remarkably early age is gorging himself on Hercule Poirot the way some children attack ice lollies.
How old were you when you read your first Agatha Christie?
2 or 3 months ago.
And how old were you then?
7 3/4, because I was just 8, 3, 4 weeks ago.
Which book did you read first?
Murder on the Orient Express.
And why did you choose that one?
Well, I had seen the film.
And you enjoyed the film, obviously.
Yes.
What do you like about the mysteries which she writes?
Well, you don't know the murder until the end, one. And two, they give you just about the right amount of clues. Not too many and not enough, if you know what I mean.
Do they scare you?
No.
And have you ever been able, in any of the books that you've read of hers, to spot who's done the murder before?
Yes, in Nemesis and Death in the Sky.
You got the murderer?
Yes, and I'm in the middle of both of them.
What other books of hers have you read?
Elephants Can Remember, and I'm reading Poirot's Early Cases, as well as Nemesis and Flight.
Would you like to write detective stories yourself?
I wouldn't know.
What do your parents think about it?
My mother thinks it's all right. She's read all of them. My father, he likes them, but not too much. He's only read 3 of them.
And what do you enjoy most about them?
That the murders are done in a good way, and they've been done properly, if you know what I mean.
But we're still looking for the secret of her success. Is there a secret? Is it simply that she begins leading you into the heart of the mystery before you're even aware of it? I think it was Ian Fleming who said that the formula of success was to make the reader reach the bottom of the page and then turn over to the next one. Perhaps the secret, one of the secrets of Dame Agatha's magic formula, is to start a little further back, to make sure that after you've read the first sentence at the top of the page, you go on reading the second and then the third, and never mind turning the page, because you've already been hooked. Here's how she begins one of her most popular books.
It is difficult to know quite where to begin this story, but I have fixed my choice on a certain Wednesday at luncheon at the vicarage. I had just finished some boiled beef when I remarked in a most unbecoming spirit that anyone who murdered Colonel Prothero would be doing the world at large a service. My nephew Dennis said instantly, "That'll be remembered against you when the old boy is found bathed in blood."
That came, needless to say, from Murder at the Vicarage. And here's another.
It was in the June of 1935 that I came home from South America. It had been a difficult time for us out there, and I need hardly say that one of my first reactions on reaching England was to look up my old friend, Hercule Poirot.
Ah, Poirot. Now we know that we're in safe hands right through that unpleasant business of the ABC murders. Another one? A typical Christie beginning, this, the opening sentences of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, one of her very best, and certainly one of the cleverest.
Mrs. Ferrers died on the night of the 16th, 17th September, a Thursday. I was sent for at 8 o'clock on the morning of Friday, the 17th. But there was nothing to be done. She had been dead for some hours. I am not going to pretend that at that moment I foresaw the events of the next few weeks, but my instinct told me that there were stirring times ahead.
I suppose everyone has their favourite Christie. Some like the Hercule Poirot stories more than Miss Marple, some like Miss Marple more than Poirot. It hardly matters. The one quality she has, which matters more than any other, is the quality known as unput-downability. Here's writer Julian Simmons.
My own favourite is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. This is an early Christie, published in 1926, And it really, it's so marvellously skilful. One mustn't give away the secret of it now, but I think one ought to go on to say, I mean, she doesn't actually like that very much. When the murder of Roger Ackroyd is mentioned, she says, oh dear, surely I've written something better than that. But all the books written between, I suppose, about 1932 and 1950 are really, as I say, absolutely dazzling. The skill of this, the skill with which she shows you the ace of spades, and then she turns over the card and it turns out to be the queen of diamonds. That is her essential skill, a sort of conjuring skill. The skill with which she does that in half a dozen books, like the ABC murders, 10 Little Niggers, and so on, is really astonishing.
And the elusive secret of her astonishing success? A final comment from Nigel Stark and Dame Agatha herself.
Well, I think the answer to that, I presume to say so, is that a chessboard has so many squares on it. There are no more than those. And I think this is the way Dame Agatha works. I think that she knows that there are certain rules. There's a certain format which she has adopted usually throughout all her works. And it's an extremely ingenious piece of chess play. That's the way I feel about it.
I do find one's friends are curious about the way one works. What is your method, they want to know? Well, the disappointing truth is that I haven't much method. I type my own drafts on an ancient but faithful machine I've owned for years, and I find a dictaphone useful for short stories or for recasting an act of a play, but not for the more complicated business of working out a novel. No, I think the real work is done in thinking out the development of your story and worrying about it until it comes right. That may take quite a while. Then when you've got all your materials together, as it were, all that remains is to try to find time to write the thing. 3 months seems to me quite a reasonable time to complete a book, if one can get right down to it. On the other hand, plays, I think, are better written quickly. And of course, writing plays is much more fun than writing books. You haven't got to bother about long descriptions of places and people, or about deciding how to space out your material. And you must write pretty fast, to keep in the mood, and to keep the talk flowing naturally.
The voice of the mysterious Dame Agatha, and that programme was first broadcast in 1975. It was presented by Cliff Michelmore, and the reader was Barbara Markham.